tell you a story. Not long ago, high on a mountain in Idaho, I was living free. So I sold off shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down. Down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down. And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys, don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please,
please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge.
Please, please don't shoot me down.
Kids on Ruby Ridge,
please, please don't shoot me down. Down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge,
please don't shoot me down. And this is Truth Quest with Melody and Eric. And that was Eric on the Bluegrass Conspiracy, and the song is called Ruby Ridge. Tonight, we have a very special guest, Jerome Corsi, and also with me is my guest host, Eric Carlstrom. And we're trying to fumble around because they're doing a little few little things here we don't normally do here. And by the way, this is KHEN LP 106.9 Salida. And the temperature outside is 33 degrees. Before we get started, I'm going to say the opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on this show do not necessarily represent the views of KHEN, its staff, or board of directors. Jerome, are you there?
Yes, Melody. How are you?
Okay, it's going to take me a second here just to get the volume corrected on
sure,
here.
Sure, I'm all set, ready to go.
Okay, I'm going to go over a little bit of his bio a second. Dr. Corsi received a Ph.D. from Harvard University in political science in 1972. He has written many books and articles, including co-authoring the number one New York Times bestseller, Unfit for Command, Swift Boat Veterans Speak Out Against John Kerry, with Swift Boat veteran John O'Neill. Dr. Corsi is an expert in political violence and terrorism. In 1981, he received a top-secret clearance from the Agency for International Development, where he assisted in providing anti-terrorism training to embassy personnel. Over the past 20 years, Dr. Corsi has developed financial services companies with leading expertise in the sales of insurance and securities products and services in the bank marketplace, both nationally and internationally. And then in March 2005, he published Atomic Iran, How the Terrorist Regime Bought the Bomb and American Politicians. In October 2005, Dr. Corsi published a book with The Politics of Oil, entitled Black Gold Stranglehold, The Myth of Scarcity and the Politics of Oil. And then his current book that he has just come out with, and whoops, I didn't see it here. Thought it was on this page.
The current book is the Late Great USA, The Coming Merger with Mexico and Canada.
There you go. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Okay, well.
That's become a bestseller. It's in the fourth printing right now.
Wow, already. Because it hasn't, it's been out about a month or two?
It's been out since July 4th. And
oh, really?
Done extremely well.
Oh.
It's been a consistently selling book. I've been very pleased with it.
And you've done, you've really hit quite a bit of the alternative circuit, as far as I know, and probably the mainstream circuit for media.
Well, it's certainly been covered extensively on Lou Dobbs and Glenn Beck, and it's gotten increasing mainstream media coverage. And I'd say there are, you know, millions of people that now know about the potential to create a North American Union because I wrote the book.
Okay.
And I'm very pleased about the success the book has had.
Well, I guess so, and that's and it sounds like you'll probably do even better, because if you've only been out 6 months and you've done that well, I would figure that.
I think this book will have a long-term cycle to it. I think it'll stay around and be in print for a long time.
Okay. When I started looking back over your bio and some of the stuff, because you work with WorldNet Daily. As a
staff reporter. I'm a staff reporter. I write almost every day on WorldNet Daily.
Wow. So, you look prolific on there, by the way, and you cover a lot of different subjects.
Yes.
So how did you get to this point of where you're at with the background, anywhere from the insurance and securities products and, you know, coming from Harvard and working in graduating in political science?
Well, I was always, even when I was young, I was very involved in politics. My father was a labor union executive with the Brotherhood of Railroad Trainmen in Cleveland. When I was growing up, he helped create the United Transportation Union. So from as early as I can remember, I was involved in politics, and I knew it and understood it. And, you know, had a remarkable ability, interest myself. I mean, it always captivated me from the time I was very young. And I wrote books when I was young, largely on politics. I had published two books by the time I got to Harvard for graduate school, and I think that's probably largely one of the reasons I got accepted into Harvard. And at Harvard, I worked with the Lindbergh Center for the Study of Violence at Brandeis. I did more research and more publishing, was researching the anti-war movement. It was the first studies I did on John Kerry and the anti-war movement and the Vietnam Veterans Against the War during the Vietnam War. And then I taught for universities for 10 years, did research for the federal government, a lot of different projects, federally funded research. And in 1981, I decided to change careers. I went into finance, and I spent 25 years working around the world, throughout the United States, working with banks to transition to sell insurance and securities products to get into financial planning, which banks in the United States were prevented from doing by the Glass-Steagall Act for a long time. And when I wrote Unfit for Command in 2004, I decided to go back to politics full-time and writing full-time, and now I'm a staff reporter for, you know, WorldNet Daily, but I still have my securities licenses intact. I've had very broad experience in my lifetime, and I continue to utilize it to write on current events.
As far as what made you write this last book? I mean, what is it about? How did you get into this North American Union as a focus?
Well, I wrote a book with Jim Gilchrist, who is the founder of the Minutemen Project. It was called Minutemen, The Battle to Secure America's Borders. And I couldn't figure out why George Bush was leaving our borders with Mexico and Canada wide open. I mean, we're now 6 years into a war on terror, and it makes no sense at all to have open borders, especially when the 9/11 hijackers were all, you know, here illegally on one pretext or another. And I documented in the book. the late great USA, that this case of Muhammad Kurani, he bribed Mexican officials in Beirut. He came across the border with Mexico with coyotes and set up shop in Dearborn, Michigan. He was sending money back to Hezbollah terrorists in Lebanon, and he's in federal prison. So there's proof positive. I don't have to speculate or allege that terrorists have come across the border. That case proves it. And George Bush has yet left our border with Mexico open. Well, it's a major rule in politics that nothing happens by accident. So rather than assuming that, you know, George Bush forgot, he was busy one weekend and he forgot to close the border, I presumed he left the border open, George Bush, because that's the way he wanted it. And I found this Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America, which, you know, many experts were pointing to me and saying that's the reason. As George Bush of Waco, Texas, in March 23, 2005, agreed that we were not NAFTA anymore. We're now in the Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America. And I think that's an agreement to increasingly open our borders with Mexico and Canada and to put the United States on the same track that Europe went on over 25 years, starting with trade agreements, like the coal and steel agreement, you know, 50 years ago this year, 1957. And Europe ending up now in the European Union with its own currency, the euro. And our elite are saying, okay, we've gone from NAFTA to the Security and Prosperity Partnership in North America. They're talking now about a North American Union. And I'm saying if we don't write about this and get people to be aware of it, we'll end up with a North American Union like the European Union. And our elite have already coined our currency. They're calling it the Amero, the A-M-E-R-O. As opposed to the euro. And if the elite can name the currency, I think we better take the plan seriously.
Yes. And in fact, I've even heard that some of its art may have already been printed. Have you heard that? Or?
Well, I can't find any Amero printed. There's a coin designer who has stamped some, you know, commemorative, you know, fantasy coins on the Amero, and he's selling them. And I've written about him in WorldNet Daily, but that's not anyone, you know, any mint officially printing the Amero. I think it's been discussed, though, extensively in academic literature and is being discussed by the bankers and, you know, even the Council on Foreign Relations. 2 issues ago, Ben Steele, one of their top economists, wrote an article declaring the end of the national monetary currency, saying that we need to move through regional currencies like the Amero to head to a one-world currency, and that's been openly published by the Council on Foreign Relations. So there's a lot of, you know, academic and, you know, economists, professional economists, writing about regional currencies and talking about the end of the dollar.
Do you know the reason why they would need to collapse the dollar and bring over the Amero, or why wouldn't they just exchange them over and then, you know, create all these different currencies?
Well, the elitists have worked in an incremental way. They've step by step kind of created fait accomplis. You know, we've got 1/10 of Mexico's population living in the United States right now, with 47 Mexican consular offices protecting their civil rights to live in our country as foreign citizens. Mexican nationals. Nobody voted for that. George Bush just left the borders open. 60% of those people have come in while George Bush has been president. And it's the same with the Amero. We would never give up the dollar unless the dollar were largely devalued. And I spent a whole chapter of the late great USA arguing that one of the plans would be to cause the dollar to go down in value. And that's what's happening right now. I mean, the dollar today hit a new low against the euro historically. Now, you know, $1.48 for a euro. When George Bush took office, it was 97 cents for a euro. The Canadian dollar is now worth more than the U.S. dollar. And I'm saying that as our currency is depressed and devalued, you know, eventually we're going to hear, well, the only way we can compete is if we have a regional currency. Otherwise, Americans are going to suffer the devaluation of the dollar and the loss of our purchasing power internationally. And that's, I think, how it's happening. And I, as I read the you know, the Wall Street Journal every day and watch the economic news, I think the chapter I wrote on the Amero is coming true.
Well, that's kind of what I've been hearing, but I just never quite under, I don't grasp the fact that they had to make it to collapse, but I kind of understand now after you've explained it. I mean, because if there's nothing really backing the dollar, then probably nothing would be backing the Amero. Am I correct?
It'd be another fiat currency, just like the dollar is. And the proposals include the creation of a North American central bank that would sit on top of the U.S. Federal Reserve. You know, even the Federal Reserve is not a government institution. It's a private bank. Most people don't know that or realize that. And the bankers want there to be a regional currency. The Federal Reserve, you know, is a transitional state there. The multinational corporations that want are already beyond borders want a regional currency so they can operate in North America with one set of regulations that they determine and a currency so they don't have currency risk. The only advisor to this North American Competitiveness Council is the Security and Prosperity Partnership is advised by the North American Competitiveness Council. And that's a group of 30 hand-picked, you know, Chamber of Commerce in each of the countries picked 10 corporations that were multinationals, and they're the only advisors of these SPP working groups. Again, there's no public interest groups, there's no labor groups, there's no C-SPAN. It's a multinational corporate agenda that we're being driven on to create a North American Union.
Well, what it sounds like to me, what you're describing with the Security Prosperity Partnership, isn't it kind of another name for bringing in a fascistic government?
I think many people, kind of with good reason, see it that way because the fundamental fascist idea, you know, Hitler, Mussolini, was that the corporations ought to rule. And the government's role was to set the stage where the corporations would be in charge. It was a military corporate state. And I think, you know, even Dwight Eisenhower warned us about this in his farewell address when he said, you know, beware the military corporate establishment. You know, this whole idea that we would get a combination of the military and corporations. Corporations rule for profit. And they are not historically very respectful of human rights. I mean, corporate unbridled capitalism, like we're doing right now, and I read about in the book, it tends to utilize slaves or near slaves. And the idea is to plug this, you know, North American, you know, common market into a World Trade Organization where they ultimately can outsource the jobs to China and India. And in China right now, China uses not only real slaves, political prisoners who make goods for the U.S. market, but they also use near slaves, people who are paid 40, 50 cents an hour, work long hours, live in compounds where they're also charged their room and board. When they're 20 years old, they're thrown out. There's a 13-year-old that will replace them and do the job faster and for less money. This is a form of slavery, even if it's not called slavery, because it's all below-market labor. And it's market labor at a below-subsistence level. And, you know, we shouldn't be allowing this. We decided at the end of the Civil War that it was immoral to use African-American slaves in Southern agricultural businesses. We can't now just go wink-wink and say it's okay to use Chinese slaves as long as we can't see them.
Okay, so who is behind this Security Partnership?
It's a multinational corporate agenda. I think, you know, the corporations, we've taken a look at this North American Competitiveness Council that advises the SPP working groups. If you go to spp.gov, and by the way, in the book I've got 30 pages of footnotes. Most of them are websites, largely government websites, so you can go see with your own eyes the evidence behind every claim I'm making. I think the corporations want there to be, you know, regulations, three sets of regulations in North America, different regulations in Canada, Mexico, and the United States, cost money to the corporations. And they want there to be, you know, they're opposed to workplace safety, red dye, food additives, pesticides. Multinational corporations want to write these regulations on a continental basis in their favor and have one currency to operate on so that they can say, look, we'll all be fine as long as corporate profits on a multinational basis are strong. You know, you read, you know, it's a flat earth. We're all taught it's a flat earth. And so we ought to be able to globally interact. Well, these are all formulas to say we can go get somebody to do your job cheaper than you. Okay. It's all a formula to have wages rush to the bottom.
Okay, my co-host would like to ask you something.
Yeah, if I could interject, Jerry, everything you say does indeed sound like what's happening to me.
Right.
And it seems that this multinational corporate agenda, these people also would oppose things like the Bill of Rights and minimum wage and unions and everything that would allow a middle class to persist, everything that would guarantee the quality of life for the average citizen.
Correct. I mean, Go try to establish a labor union in China or in Mexico. You know, you'd have more luck in China bringing Bibles in and teaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. You get put in prison for that. You get put in prison for creating a labor union. These are not free societies, and we should not be allowing. We used to have in classical free trade agreements, and these agreements we're signing now are not free trade agreements. They're not fair agreements. Classical economists, you know, going back to Ricardo, knew that you had to have fair agreements, or you would damage your own economy. And we used to have anti-dumping provisions where if a country like China used slaves to intentionally dump on our market goods that were produced at way below cost of labor that we could do here, that's a direct assault on our market and our labor, and we would put tariffs against those goods traditionally under honest free trade agreements. These agreements are written by the multinational corporations because they, like Chrysler, say, well, we'll just go over to China, make a deal with Chery, a Chinese auto manufacturer, and we'll make our cars over there by near slaves and import them to the United States.
Where does the UN come in on this? Are they involved in this?
Well, the UN is another one of these, you know, multinational organizations that those proponents who are working towards a world government, a new world order, see, well, you first get the European Union. The plans I write about and point to, and I'm increasingly seeing even the Council on Foreign Relations, you know, Ben Steele talking about these regional currencies. They have the idea that there'd be a North American Union with a currency, European Union with a currency, African Union with a regional currency, and an Asian Union with a regional currency. Then those could be put together into a world government structure. And the United Nations is kind of the prototype, you know. This whole thing goes back, it's both the left and the right. I want to make it clear, it's both Democrat and Republican alike. You know, George Soros is saying nation states belong to the days when kings had castles, because George Soros has in his mind some kind of a socialist paradise in which the proletariat, you know, the workers rule. Of course, George Soros, like Hegel, never really met a bureaucrat. I'm more like Aristotle. I think everything is politics, and I don't trust bureaucrats. And on the right, you got David Rockefeller. Rockefeller Republicans. They say our corporations are already multinational. You know, your nation states are a pest. And besides, our multinational corporations make billions in profits. Your nation-state governments are broke. And, you know, this pressure to destroy the nation-state is one that I see going on in both the left and the right. And the multinational corporations ultimately think they'll win because they have the money. They're happy the socialists are such, you know, comfortable fools because they're happy to employ the millions of the Mexican underclass coming to the United States as exploited labor. And make no second guess about it. You know, if Tyson's Foods and Governor Huckabee, when he was in Arkansas, couldn't hire illegal aliens below market, they wouldn't have wanted them. And the middle class, again, pays the bill because the middle class gets to pay the social welfare benefits, which become a subsidy. And over a long period of time, maybe 25 years, 50 years, our middle class is destroyed, and the whole world begins to look like Mexico. You've got one class at the top that's the millionaires and billionaires and the people who own, operate, and manage the multinational corporations. The bottom are all the rest of us. And the people who support these plans and the politicians they pay for all imagine they'll be in the first category of the haves. They envision us in the have-nots, and they don't care.
So where do they picture us being? I mean, so since they've moved so many of our corporations and that over to Asia, what are they planning on doing with the North American Union as far as production for their corporations?
Well, Alan Blinder, who's a professor at Princeton, and he advised Bill Clinton to get NAFTA passed. Blinder said in the Wall Street Journal this past March, he admitted that under his plans, following his advice, going to this so-called free trade, this globalism, we will lose 40 million jobs in the United States in the next two decades. 40 million. That's twice as many manufacturing jobs as we currently have. That'll reduce the United States to a third world status. But the multinational corporations will be happy because they'll be finding the cheapest labor on the face of the earth to do their work. It's a license to go get slaves. And, the idea is that what's left of the American market, because it's very big, will still be a marketplace to sell goods. And our multinational corporations envision that over time, they'll also be able to sell goods in China. So in the United States, if they can get slave labor now in China, it does no good to produce the goods where the cost of labor is close to zero. It would cost a lot to transport those goods into the United States. So now they've got to reduce the cost of transportation of these containers from China to as close to zero as possible, and that's where the NAFTA superhighways come in.
And could you explain those a little bit, Jerry?
Sure. Well, right now, the containers from China largely come into West Coast ports like Long Beach and Los Angeles, and they're too expensive because we've got longshoremen, which are labor union workers, working in Los Angeles and Long Beach. And when the containers have to be trucked or trained into the interior of the United States, you've got U.S. truckers who are expensive, and you've got U.S. train workers who are United Transportation workers, and they're expensive too. So the idea is to open up these ports in Mexico, like south of Texas. If you look at the map on the Pacific, there's these Mexican ports of Lazaro Cardenas and Manzanilla. They're open to make deep water, and by the way, they're managed by the Communist Chinese and Hutchison Ports Holdings. So and the Chinese are putting billions of dollars into deepening these ports, making them modern. So if these huge container ships, and now we're now building container ships for China that will hold 12,500 containers, that's three times the container ship you've ever seen. It's like moving, 10 square blocks of skyscrapers from Manhattan on the ocean. Well, these container ships can dock at Mexican ports. They can get unloaded with Mexican trucks. Mexican dock workers, they can be put on Mexican trucks and Mexican trains. The whole buzzword is intermodal. That means the container can come from China on a ship, picked up by a crane and put on a truck or a train, different modes of transportation, without the container being repacked, cheap, cheap, cheap. And it can be brought by cheap labor, Mexican trucks or Mexican trains, into the interior of the United States. This now reduces the cost of transporting those containers. And you've got cities like, Kansas City, San Antonio, and Denver declaring themselves to be inland ports. Well, where's the water? In Kansas City, it's not the Kansas River. It's not the Riverwalk in San Antonio. It's not the Platte River in Denver. The water is Lazaro Cardenas and Manzanilla, these Mexican ports. And the idea is these intermodal containers will get brought to these huge warehouses and then picked up by trucks and brought to the local Walmarts, Kmarts, and whatever marts. And this is the way our transportation infrastructure across the country. And Texas is saying, well, we'll just develop a new Trans-Texas corridor, 4 football fields wide of a brand new highway, parallel to Interstate 35, and it's going to be financed by Spain, by CINTRA, a Spanish investment consortium. And they're fighting now in Oklahoma to extend it to Oklahoma, because the plan is to take it up parallel to Interstate 35 all the way into Canada. And Kansas City even has voted $3 million to put a Mexican customs office in the heart of Kansas City. I mean, I couldn't make this stuff up.
Yeah, this is fascinating, and you're explaining it very, very lucidly. Now, do you have an idea whose plan this is? I mean, more specifically than just, say, the multinational corporations?
Well, you know, you can take a look at the corporations who are on the North American Competitiveness Council. You've got companies like Kansas City Southern. They're one of the primary sponsors of this. Of course, they bought the railroads in Mexico. Until I started writing about it, they used to call themselves the NAFTA Railroad. I've got other corporations like Walmart. There are the corporations who are on the North American Competitiveness Council and tend to benefit from this plan economically. You've got an intellectual elite. I point to Robert Pastor. He's a professor at American University. Pastor's been writing for 10 years about building a North American community. He wrote a book called Toward a North American Community, in which he openly advocated the Amero and the creation of a North American central bank. Pastor's not just an academic. When he was in the Carter administration, he was on the National Security Council, and he engineered giving the Panama Canal to Panama.
So what you're saying here is this plan couldn't be 10 or 20 or even 30 or 40 years old. They've been in the works with this for quite a while. Am I right?
I see intellectual bases of the North American Union going back to, 10, 20 years, and following the European Union and saying, hey, that's if it works in Europe, let's do it here.
Yeah, but since you've got the European Union, who was the beginning point. These guys, plan these things like, it could be 50, 60 years in advance or more.
Except I think that the second time around, they intend to compress the time frame. So there's a lot of discussion about putting it into the institutions of a North American community in place by 2010. There's discussion of having the Amero introduced by 2010. I think by 2025 this time, maybe 25 years, the elite in North America think they can accomplish what it took 50 years to do in Europe.
And you don't see that being melded into the UN's Agenda 21?
Well, I mean, the UN's got lots of agendas that are compatible. But I think if you read even what the Council on Foreign Relations is writing, the idea is to create these regional structures first and make sure the regional structures are in place, and then start moving to merge those together. So the UN is kind of saying, okay, their Agenda 21 and other documents and, initiatives the UN puts out are kind of showing you where the world government thinkers are headed. But it'll still be done on a regional basis. There'll be a need to create a North American Union before it's merged into a world government structure.
Oh, I don't doubt that. I was just trying to look at the little bit bigger picture on
this.
They're
very compatible. Yeah. When you look at the Agenda 21, it's very compatible with everything I've talked about today.
Would you care to define Agenda 21, one of you, just so our readers are
well, Agenda 21 was basically, let's just put it this way, because it's an agenda that the UN set out for putting in place world government structures. And it set out a fairly detailed kind of set of plans for what their vision was for how that would go. I mean, and I don't want to get too off track by going into too much detail on Agenda 21. I usually, when people ask me, they say, well, what about the Bilderbergers and all these other issues? The Agenda 21 is around sustainable development, I don't want to get off track onto that theme. I stay very close to what I can get evidence to report. And I've got the hard goods on the, you know, the Security and Prosperity Partnership. There's websites I can point to. They go to spp.gov.
How about the NCPPP?
SPP, like sampeterpaul.gov. And I can say, go read the, look at the left-hand bars and read the 2005 and 2006 report to the leaders. I can say, look at the, you know, the working groups that they describe we've created, these 20 working groups with Mexico and Canada. It's very concrete. Same, I say, go to, you know, keeptexasmoving.com and navigate towards the Trans-Texas Corridor portion of that website. I can show them the, you know, the artist's rendition of the 4-football-field-wide highway and what it looks like. When you start talking about the, you know, Agenda 21 and sustainable development, you're off into theory, and it's not nearly as applied as that our government's created, you know, 20 working groups with our bureaucrats meeting with Mexico's bureaucrats and Canada's bureaucrats. And on page 81 of the book, I can print the organizational chart of those working groups that I got in a Freedom of Information Act request. And it's a formal organizational trilateral structure, reporting to cabinet-level officers in each country and to the heads of state, but not published as an organizational chart on the website of any one of these three governments. I can say, look, that's a shadow government. It's in place, and I can document it. So that's a lot more concrete than talking about the Agenda 21 of the UN.
Okay, when you make the comment trilateral, does that have anything to do with the Trilateral Commission?
Well, again, it does the same way that Agenda 21 is involved. It's another group of globalists thinking about the same line. What I'm saying, these are trilateral working groups, is that, for instance, the Transportation Working Group is headed in the U.S. by Jeffrey Shane, who is an undersecretary of transportation for policy under Mary Peters, who's the Secretary of Transportation. It's headed by a similar undersecretary in Mexico and a similar undersecretary in Canada. And these three top bureaucrats also then recruit in the Department of Transportation of each of the three countries participants who work on these working groups. And I've got hundreds of pages of their emails, setting up meetings together, an organizational chart where that reports to three cabinet secretaries, you know, Secretary of State Rice, Gutierrez in Commerce, and Chertoff in Homeland Security, and then reports into the White House, the Homeland Security Council, National Security Council, and little boxes end up in the office of the president. So it's very concrete. These are trilateral commissions that I can show the organizational chart of. They exist, and that's a shadow government, because our government won't publish that organizational chart. Somebody just put it in the pile of papers they sent to me in the Freedom of Information Act request.
And it seems that our mainstream media doesn't have much interest in publishing much about this kind of thing either.
No, increasingly the mainstream media, you know, is owned by the multinational corporations too. I mean, Murdoch owns Fox. He's now bought the Wall Street Journal. He doesn't want me using the Wall Street Journal or Fox to talk about how globalism is a threat to the national sovereignty of the United States. He wants everybody to think globalism is good. I was on a panel with one of the top editorial writers of the Wall Street Journal, and he was going on about globalism. Look at all these low-cost goods we have as a result of it, how wonderful this is. And I said, you know, Mr. Moore is praising globalism only because he doesn't think the Wall Street Journal can find two PhDs in India who can write his columns for half his cost. And I want to call up Mr. Moore 6 months after Mr. Murdoch owns the Wall Street Journal and see what he thinks then of globalism.
And it really seems to me that what you're doing, Jerry, is classic deep investigative reporting, the kind of reporting that the media perhaps once did but no longer seems capable of doing.
That's right. All I'm doing is I'm taking what they say and going and getting the documents. I'm looking at what they do, and I'm showing the people the documents. And I'm saying, you know, if you look to SPP.gov and the myths versus facts, it says it's a dialogue between three countries that, on, you know, want to be globally competitive. I say dialogues when you call up your friend and say, how are you doing? It's not when you have a formal organizational chart three nations of the trilateral bureaucracy that you won't publish. That's a shadow government. That's what you do when you're having an administrative coup d'etat.
You were mentioning, too, about that, you know, being cheaper for them to bring in their goods and utilize these corridors. But from what I understand, traveling on those corridors isn't going to be inexpensive at all.
Well, it'd be expensive for you and me. But even if the multinational corporations have to pay tolls to use those corridors, like the Trans-Texas Corridor, you know, they'll be able to drive 90 miles an hour paying the tolls, and they won't have had to pay to build the road. Spain will build the road. So it's a great deal for the multinational corporations that want to drive their containers up and down that road or have the trains take it up and down the road. The trains, like, Union Pacific or CSX, they don't have eminent domain. They can't steal the land to buy that property. The state of Texas can. You know, the state of Texas can go and say, well, look, we can just take this land. They have quick take in Texas, which means that if they make you an offer on your land, on eminent domain, and on the 90th day you don't take the offer, on the 91st day Texas can just steal it. And this is all under the Kelo decision of the Supreme Court, which, you know, said that you can use eminent domain even if the definition of public good benefits a private group like the Sintra in Spain.
Does that kind of fly in the face of the Constitution?
A lot of this flies in the face of the Constitution. I mean, I've looked all over the Constitution. I don't find a single paragraph about, you know, working groups. And George Bush did not take the Security and Prosperity Partnership and bring it to Congress either as a law or a treaty. He did it under his own authority. And that's why, again, I say it's an administrative coup d'etat. It's being intentionally kept under the radar. We're putting in place the administrative structure for a North American Union by fait accompli, the same way it was done in Europe. Nobody on this phone conversation or listening voted to have 10% of Mexico's population living in the United States. It just happened, right? Well, George Bush intentionally left the borders open. By 2010, we'll have 20% of Mexico's population living here. That's less than 3 years from now.
But isn't that also after when the borders were kind of dropped before and that we flooded the Mexican market with our goods that forced the farming to collapse and they even the farmers couldn't even support themselves?
The whole issue in Mexico under NAFTA has been that, the Mexican farmers, which are largely peasant farmers, paid very little. The multinational corporations want to destroy them too. And the first impulse of NAFTA was to, bring people out of the interior of the country and bring them to work in these maquiladoras along the border, these assembly factories. In the 1990s, there were about 3 million people, again, making slave wages in these maquiladoras. Now it's down to about 1.5 million or 1 million working in those maquiladoras because the labor's gone to China. It had nothing to do with anything except the multinational corporations taking over the markets in North America and forcing the wages down to the bottom.
So the multinational corporations then are just kind of moving from country to country, going in, bringing everybody down to this third world level.
Precisely.
Right, okay.
And if China's labor organizes, they'll find slaves somewhere else.
So what we're really looking at is a gigantic system of monopoly capitalism.
Yes.
In which basically the age of the robber barons has come back full force in a much more organized manner.
Right, with, George Orwell language, security and prosperity.
Yes, yeah.
This is for your good. If you click, I'm sure, the SPP.gov website the right way, it'll play you Bobby McFerrin music. Don't worry, be happy. This is for your own good.
Okay, so in identifying the problem, have you uncovered anything to be a solution for it?
Well, as I write in the book, I think it's going to take grassroots efforts. And it's starting. There's now 14 states that have passed resolutions saying no North American Union, no NAFTA superhighway. There's brave politicians like Randy Brogdon, a Republican senator in Oklahoma, saying the NAFTA superhighway will not cross the Oklahoma border and building coalitions within these states of voters who are saying it's not in our interest to be overwhelmed by Mexican illegal immigrants who will become the next underclass to undercut wages and be exploited by the corporations. When people stand up and say no, now, the one thing that the Europeans counted on, the elite of multinational corporations, was they could keep lying, and nobody would stand up and expose it. If we expose this, the people of the United States understand it. George Bush operates like the multinationals. I mean, he's in their agenda. He's paid by them, as his father was, and Bill Clinton, too. Remember, Bill Clinton never saw a campaign contribution, legal or illegal, from the Chinese he didn't like. He took them all.
Well, it kind of sounds to me like we'd almost have to get support from not just this state to state or country to North American countries, but we would have to do this on a worldwide level to plug all the holes. So these.
Well, it starts here. Mm-hmm. We start by saying no. I don't go along. Oklahoma says no. If Oklahoma stands fast, that Trans-Texas Corridor isn't going to serve the purpose it was created for. It'll have to stop at the Oklahoma border. And Sentra can build the highway. Nobody's going to use it. If we stand fast and say, we're going to now start demanding either get out of NAFTA, get out of the World Trade Organization, or make these classically fair trade agreements. Bring back the anti-dumping provisions. Support U.S. labor. If we don't support U.S. labor, we're voting against you, Democrat and Republican alike. And if your replacement comes in, we'll vote against them, too, until we get politicians who will listen to we the people. We the people are sovereign. It's not the multinational corporations, and it does not say in the Constitution, I, the President. It says we the people. That's what our Declaration of Independence says.
We certainly seem to have a dictator now, King George, you might even say. Would you, are there politicians or groups that you would suggest we can rally behind at this point?
Well, I think Ron Paul, a Republican from Texas, congressman running for president, has been clear and outspoken on these issues. He's articulated the North American Union. He's fought against NAFTA. He's for the Constitution. Duncan Hunter, Republican congressman from California, from San Diego, he's also on these issues, as is Tom Tancredo. And increasingly, the politicians are, instead of the fluff questions they're asked at these silly debates, you know, do you like diamonds or pearls better?
Right.
Give me a break. They ought to be asked, you know, where are you in the North American Union? Where are you in the Security and Prosperity Partnership? What do you think of NAFTA? I mean, and I think the American people are tired of NAFTA. I think if you put SPP, the Security and Prosperity Partnership, to a referendum, the United States or Canada would be overwhelmingly voted down. And I think if our politicians could quit writing letters to their constituents with the talking points, you know, oh, this is just dialogue, it's for our competitiveness in a global economy, people ought to send back, I don't want a global economy. Global economy is no good for me. You're just telling me somebody in China as a slave could do my job better than me. Why is Bill Gates, got to be the most loyal American on the face of the earth? He dropped out from college. We bought his software products from Microsoft. Now he won't take our kids as his computer scientists coming out of our colleges. He wants unlimited HB1 visas because he wants to make another $1 billion. He's already the wealthiest billionaire, one of them in the world. He wants H1 visas so he can get cheap computer scientists from India. Give me a break. Break up at Microsoft and close it down.
Well, it seems like the corporations are actually moving in the other direction. As
good. Well, let them go in the other direction.
Right.
I watched a Marx Brothers movie called, you know, Night at the Circus or Day at the Circus when I was a kid. And, you know, Groucho put the orchestra on a barge. And it, out upon this lake or ocean, they cut it loose, and the barge floated it out to ocean. Well, he opened the drapery in the banquet hall, and they saw the circus. Well, I think we ought to put the multinational corporations and Congress and George W. Bush and Hillary Clinton on the barge and cut it loose. Let them float out to the ocean and play music for themselves.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Have you got some particular places you would recommend? That obviously reading your book would be a real good way to, for people to educate themselves on this. What other books, what other websites would you suggest that people inform themselves with?
Well, in the book I've given great references. Just take the book and look at the references. Go look at the government websites yourself. All my articles I'm writing almost daily on WorldNet Daily as a staff writer. I put in links. If you click those hot links, you can see the government documents. And, you know, I kind of believe here that it's, like the old country western song. You know, the woman finds her husband in bed with another woman. And she looks, you know, knows the lying's going to start. You know, the husband's going to say, "Dear, this is not what you think it is." And she's going to start hearing about how they had dictation to do and it's kind of cold in the room. Or she has a choice. She can decide to believe her own lying eyes. Well, I think if people look at the footnotes in the late great USA, they're going to start believing their own lying eyes. Because what I'm saying is true, and I give you the government websites to see where the public-private partnerships are being planned, where the Trans-Texas Corridor, you know, agreement, the Comprehensive Development Agreement is signed with Sintra in Spain, and you can see it. I give you the Blackwell and Giuliani website. You can see how Rudy Giuliani's law firm has been the sole representative of Sintra to get this Trans-Texas Corridor built. I give you the websites that show you where the, you know, globalists are at work within our government. And if you read them for yourselves, you'll see it's fully documented, and you can start demanding the congressmen and senators fess up to why they don't know equally about it, which you know from studying the footnotes and reading the book.
And this is something we can get on Amazon.com or something?
Yeah, the late great USA, the coming merger with Mexico and Canada. If you look it up with my name, Jerome, J-E-R-O-M-E, Corsi, C-O-R-S-I. The book is in the fourth printing. It's available on WorldNet Daily. They ship it immediately. There's copies also on WorldNetDaily.com. All together, worldnetdaily.com, where I write almost daily as a staff reporter. And it is in the bookstores. It's in Barnes & Noble's. It's in Borders. Sometimes you have to ask for it. Sometimes I hide it behind the cookbooks. If they don't have one, they'll order one for you. But it's available through those sources, and you can readily get it. It's in the fourth printing, and we've got available copies, and we're going to continue printing it as long as people want to read it.
I want to see if I hope I can, we have enough time to kind of get briefly into this one article that I ran across of yours to change the subject just a little bit. It had to do with NORAD.
Yeah.
Can you briefly tell me why you picked up that as something to write on and its importance?
Well, I've been following NORAD and NORTHCOM. They're together in a command structure. I mean, they're different organizations, but General Renart is the commander of both out at Peterson Air Force Base in Colorado Springs. And my attention started getting really interested when I realized that U.S. NORTHCOM was created as a combatant command for the U.S. military with a mission to be involved in U.S. domestic emergencies. We've, you know, been always reluctant to use the military in domestic emergencies. Post 9/11 world, we're saying there could be, you know, terrorist events or even natural disasters like Katrina, where the military might have the resources that the states don't have. And then George Bush in May signed this National Security Presidential Directive 51 and Homeland Security Presidential Directive 20, and he declared the president could say a national emergency on his own authority and then take over the direction of the federal, state, local, territorial, and tribal governments. We also had the John Warner Appropriations Act of 2007, which basically repealed Posse Comitatus, which had restrained the military from being used in domestic situations. The John Warner Appropriations Act of 2007 said the president could federalize the National Guard and send the military into domestic emergency situations. I interviewed Robert Pastor, who I mentioned before, the professor at American University, who is advocating a North American community. And Pastor wrote in Spanish, gave an interview, and I interviewed him. And he agreed that he said that the next 9/11 crisis might be what we need to move us towards a North American integration agenda. So I'm very suspicious and want to know exactly what the plans are when we're creating structures to use the military in domestic situations. Because I see the prospect of martial law and, you know, declaring we need to merge with Canada, Mexico, and create a continental border around North America that we defend. And I'm suspicious of these structures. Now, when I was out at NORTHCOM and U.S. and NORAD, I want to report that the military is now doing it responsibly. They're under civilian command, and they understand the Constitution. But if the military were given an order by the President and the Secretary of Defense to go into a situation, they'd obey the order without debating first with the President the constitutionality of his requirements. So I want the American people to be aware of things that I foresee as potential abuses if the President were someone, you know, people say, well, I like George Bush, he'd never do this. And I say, okay, well, how about Hillary Clinton? And so, you know, or people say, I like Hillary Clinton, she wouldn't abuse this. And I say, okay, how about Jeb Bush? Now, the Constitution, you know, the framers advised us not to look at powers given to the executive by the personality of who the executive was today, but to look at them in relationship to the office and to imagine the executive was somebody you didn't like.
And, of course, Jerome, many of us who have researched this topic extensively are very convinced that 911 itself was an inside job to promote a globalist agenda, in this case world domination, and a police state at home.
Well,
so,
I've not yet gotten the, as I said, I stay very close to the research, and I don't have the hard proof on that, so I'm not weighing in on that subject. But
right.
I do think there are very interesting and important questions being asked about 9/11 that demand answers.
Right.
Well, Jerome, I'd like to thank you, and we could go on doing another interview at some time, and it'd be nice if you would.
Thank you very much, Jerome. Very, yeah. Very interesting.
It's an honor to be with you and a pleasure, and I've enjoyed the time together, and I'd be happy to come back anytime you ask.
Thank you very much.
We'd love to have you.